Mesdames, Messieurs, bonjour. Bienvenue au Collège de France pour ce colloque sur les variations de la circulation globale de retournement de l'océan. Welcome to the Collège de France for this workshop, for this colloquium about the variations of the global overturning circulation of the ocean. So you have the program that is listed here, and since we are already a bit late, I will try to start for this introduction. My introduction will be mainly about some basics, probably too simple for most of the audience who are oceanographers, but I thought it would be interesting to do the lay person, because I'm not an oceanographer. And I will try also to give a glimpse of historical perspective and on long-term changes of the ocean. So to start, I just want to stress that ocean currents were mapped and studied, since a long time ago. Since the 19th century, especially by Matthew Fontaine Maury, who mapped, in fact, the currents of the ocean. So this is a picture that I have in my office, showing, in fact, his map is on the surface current, the wind-driven circulation, and we can already recognize. He was very interested in mapping this around the world, and we can recognize most of the gyres, the western boundary currents, especially the Gulf Stream, which is here, the North Atlantic Drift, etc. And he was already in the 19th century very much interested by the relationship between the surface circulation, the ocean circulation, and climate, and especially the climate of Northern Europe. So this is just a quotation from his book saying that the Gulf Stream is conveying heat from the Gulf of Mexico to northern latitude, and this was, according to him, key, in fact, to explain the mild climates of the British Isles and Western Europe. So this was already in the 19th century, so mapping the surface ocean and recognizing, in fact, the role of surface winds. The scholars were also interested by vertical movement of the ocean and trying to understand if there were some links, some communication between the surface and depths. And one of the key scholar on the field was probably the Italian scientist Marsigli, who was making observation of the Bosphorus between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. In between, there is the Marmara Sea, and he was very interested by the exchanges between the Black Sea, which is brackish, which has a salinity on the order of 18, and by contrast to the Mediterranean, with a much larger salinity. So he understood by also talking with fishermen. This is a quotation from his book in Italian from the 17th century, about the fact that you have a different flow at the surface and at depths, a flow out of the Black Sea at the surface and a flow in at depth at the Bosphorus Strait. So he understood, in fact, the role and the importance of salinity of the hydrology for understanding the movement. And he even tried, in fact, to make an experiment, the box, Marsigli's box, which is represented here with two separate boxes with very different salinities to explain, in fact, this movement of estuarine circulation between the Black Sea, which is here, and the rest of the Mediterranean or the Marmara Sea, on the other hand, with the deep flow flowing in into the Black Sea. So very early, in fact, the mechanisms that were already on the table, but it's clear that there was a clear lack of other information. It was clear for the scientists from the 19th century that there were movements that are global at the surface and at depths. One of the representation that I very much like is this 19th century global circulation in a bathtub that was represented by Joseph Ademar, a key pioneer of climate research. I mean, he's the inventor, the first scientist who proposed an astronomical theory to explain long-term climate changes and especially glaciations. And he was also interested by the ocean. In his book, Révolution de la mer, published in the mid-19th century. So you can see that he envisioned, in fact, surface currents and also deep currents in these bathtubs. Obviously, this lacked real information, and this came in the 20th century with expeditions at sea, especially from German scientists, such as famous oceanographers, Mertz, Wüst. This is a diagram showing, in fact, cross-section in the Atlantic between the northern and the southern part of the Atlantic. South is here and the north is here. And that is already 1 century old. I mean, this was published in 1922, and you can recognize, this is the temperature cross-section. This is the salinity and the velocity that was envisioned by these authors. And on the salinity, you can already recognize the main features of what we will talk about today. The formation of North Atlantic deep water is already here in this 100-year century cross-section that was constructed by the German oceanographers at the time. So they recognized very early, and we know that now quite well, that the North Atlantic is a very special area, which is very sensitive, in fact, to heat and freshwater fluxes that lead, in fact, to changes of the density at the surface. So this is a schematic that I borrowed from Tomczak and Godfrey, where you have just a schematic representation of the warm, salty current that comes through the Gulf Stream and the North Atlantic Drift with about 20 sphere drop being a million cubic meter per second. And this flow is transporting, we will see that much better with the other talks, about 1 petawatt, 10 to the 15 watt. And this water gets cooled and gets also affected by all sorts of freshwater input or evaporation that leads in the end to convection because of the increase of density. And the convection is not taking place everywhere. It's taking place in the northern part. It's beyond, in fact, the Greenland-Scotland ridge. And as the overflow, I mean, it has to overflow above that ridge and then invade, in fact, the North Atlantic Ocean and mix it to form the NIDW, North Atlantic Deepwater. And of course, you have exchanges also with rivers, with also the Arctic. You have also the freshwater, the snowfall, the presence of sea ice that can affect everything. But this is quite recognized that the North Atlantic is very special, and obviously also the area of deepwater formation are not are quite complex, and this is just a schematic diagram showing that this is happening mainly in the Nordic seas, Greenland, Iceland, Norwegian seas, and also a component in the Labrador Sea that mixes to form the NIDW. So it's possible also to look like the German did in 1922, the properties such as salinity to identify, in fact, the deep flow of in the Atlantic. This is again a cross-section with modern instrumental measurements of salinity, where you can see the at 3 kilometer depth this tongue of high salinity that is linked to convection in the north. And it's possible also to look at other properties such as oxygen content. This is dissolved oxygen in the same water masses. What is interesting with oxygen is that it's already illustrating, in fact, the slow speed of the movement, because this disappearance, this decrease of oxygen in the deep sea is linked, in fact, to remineralization of organic matter. And the kinetics of organic matter remineralization are not very well known, but they provide some constraint about the speed of the movement. And of course, the Atlantic is connected to the other ocean. So this is the parallel cross-section in the Pacific, showing that the deep flow is also, in that case, from south to north. And it's possible, in fact, to see the different water masses in these sections for salinity and oxygen. One key information came about the speed and the rapidity of the process from in the 50s with the development of the measurement of radiocarbon as a clock to quantify the speed of deep sea currents. And this is basically using radiocarbon to date not the water, but the DIC, the dissolved inorganic carbon dissolved that is in the water mass that follows water masses. And as you know, radiocarbon is decaying with a half-life of 6,000 years. So it's very appropriate, in fact, as a tool to measure the apparent age of a water parcel after it has formed at the surface and it has been transported in the deep sea. I mean, it goes with some complexity. I mean, Luke Skinner, for example, I borrowed this from a recent review that we did in reviews of geophysics. Luke will provide much more information about all these complexities, but the initial step is that radiocarbon was really giving a clock for the deep sea, and this came in the late 50s, early 60s. So I just put it here, the four initial papers that came from different groups, in fact, from Sweden, from New Zealand, I mean, Sweden with Gert Östlund, and Scripps in California with Ansus, and Wally Broecker and his colleagues from Lamont who focus on the Atlantic. And Wally Broecker and others, I mean, we are key, in fact, to implement, in fact, a large-scale survey of carbon-14 in the deep ocean. And this is a recent compilation map of the C14 ages of water masses in the deep sea, deeper than 3 kilometers. And as you can see, this is just raw age. We can see the movement between the north and the south part of the Atlantic, and then the water during its progression to the north in the Pacific is getting older, at least with the measurement of carbon-14. So this is what led, in fact, Wally Broecker to propose his simplified and very popularized, I mean, it popularized, in fact, this cartoonesque picture of the what he called the conveyor belt of the ocean, which is represented here, which is more complex than the one with the bathtub, but still very simple, connecting, in fact, the global ocean. And this is obviously, I mean, every representation has its advantages and also drawbacks, especially when you are trying to simplify things. It's clear that you can not make mistakes, but simplify maybe at the extreme the circulation. So nobody and Wally Broecker never expected that there was a pipe in the ocean confined, in fact, to this blue and red ribbon. This is a more complete and still simplified, in fact, representation by Lynn Talley, who actually used, in fact, the term global overturning circulation. So I used that term for the title of the colloquium, which is important. I mean, this is also to insist on the fact that this circulation is global. One key aspect that was missing in this very simple representation by Wally Broecker is the passage between the Pacific at the surface, subsurface, into the Atlantic. This is probably also at the time when Wally Broecker proposed that in the 70s, 80s, this simplification, there was a very influential, is still very influential today, but a very influential oceanographer at Lamont, at Columbia, was Arnold Gordon. And Arnold Gordon was very much focused on what he called the warm root of the thermal line circulation. This is what he used as a term in his review of 1986. And he was very much interested by this warm route going through the Indonesian archipelago and the Cape Good Hope, and basically stating that the cold route through the Drake Passage was minimal in comparison to the other one. So this has changed through time, but this is, so it has been heavily criticized this cartoon due to that reason and other aspects as well. But this is, oceanography is progressing, so we know now that the importance of the Drake Passage is extreme, so the representation here is much better. The other thing that is key to illustrate the globality, the global aspect of the this global circulation, the global overturning circulation, is to make a representation showing, in fact, the Antarctica in the middle with the different, connecting, in fact, the different basins. So it shows, in fact, the central role of the Southern Ocean and the Southern circumpolar Antarctic current to mix and exchange water in the world ocean. So this is taken from the same paper by Talley, summarizing, in fact, the GOC, the global overturning circulation. That is summarizing, in fact, the global aspect. So in each sectors, you could simplify it by saying the flow is north to south or south to north, so more or less meridional. But when you have a complete view of the circulation, it's more or less global. The other aspect that was simplified probably too much at the beginning and here, the caricature did not come, in fact, to the scientists. It came, in fact, maybe from others. But the conveyor belt was of Wally Brooker was also called the thermoaligned circulation. It was just to insist on one key aspect of the circulation, namely the sinking in the North Atlantic, which is affected by, I mentioned it before, by the density increase and the overflow and the formation of deep water in the North Atlantic. Whereas, in fact, there is a combination of mechanisms. The global circulation is not pushed by the sinking in the North Atlantic. It is also pulled by different kinds of mixing and upwelling mechanism, which is important, and especially in the Southern Ocean. In fact, so in order to understand the mechanics of this global ocean circulation, overturning circulation, it's important to recognize that it's not only thermoaligned. So during 20 years, in fact, people were using the term THC, thermoaligned circulation, in lieu and place of what we refer as the GOC or meridional overturning circulation, but we are speaking about the same thing. Unfortunately, some journalists also use Gulf Stream to refer to that, which is which is definitely too extreme. This is also the reason why some very serious oceanographers are very unhappy about this simplification. But anyway, so I had also some difficulties in choosing, in fact, the title for the workshop, for the session of today, because I feel that the circulation, the retournement in French is awkward, but that's we have to live with that. So it's better, in fact, to use the term global overturning circulation. The other aspect that is important is that it's possible also to look at the circulation itself by looking at the propagation of transient traces. So tritium, bomb C14, the freons have been key, in fact, to study especially the North Atlantic. So these are cross sections at different dates: 81, 97, 2003. This is the freon map for also the late the 90s, which shows, in fact, the importance here north and south, the importance of the convection in the North Atlantic to explain, in fact, the distribution of these traces. I mean, at one point I had some interest in the thing by when I did my PhD. We were studying, in fact, the Indonesian through flow with measurements of bomb carbon 14 in the Indian Ocean. So mainly to study, in fact, the inventory and the diffusion of the propagation of bomb carbon 14 in the Indian Ocean. So this is a summary map of the inventory at different latitudes in the Indian Ocean at different time. And this was we had a big anomaly corresponding, in fact, to the Indonesian through flow. And at that time, in the late 80s, we even collaborated with the group at GFDL, with Robert Topweiler, in fact, to study that in one of the first oceanographic GCM, general circulation model. But I mean, clearly, the geometry was not appropriate to do that, but we had a go. These are the velocities and the carbon-14 that was simulated precisely to compare with what we were doing in the paper that we did in the 80s. Speaking about carbon-14, it's important to realize also that the importance of the global overturning circulation or the meridional overturning circulation is the sequestration of anthropogenic CO2, and we will speak much more, colleagues will give much more about the subject during the day. This is just a map of that is showing, in fact, the integrated concentration of anthropogenic CO2 in the ocean, expressed in micromolar per kilogram, and this is for the year 94, but it has evolved, and the map is basically the same. And we can see that, that there is an enormous anomaly in the North Atlantic, which is due to this sinking at depth and deep water formation and transport. So it's possible also to look at a cross-section of the same thing, and this is for the Atlantic. So here we are speaking about the AMOC, Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, that plays a major role. And you can see the asymmetry of the propagation and the penetration of the of anthropogenic CO2 in the northern Atlantic due to the convection. One going back to climate, in fact, one of the first scholar who recognized, in fact, even before Maury that I mentioned at the beginning with his surface current, probably the first person who recognized that the role of the ocean in explaining the temperature on the globe, the distribution of temperatures on the globe, was Alexander von Humboldt. In fact, in his book, I mean, he published in French, so I left it in French, Des lignes isothermes et de la distribution de la chaleur sur le globe, published in 1817. He did the first drawing of the isothermal lines, illustrating that there is an asymmetry in longitude between Europe and North America. And so this is a map that I have in my office, for example, showing the asymmetry of the mean annual isothermal line. And this is a recent map that was constructed on the purpose of restudying the effect of the ocean and the North Atlantic circulation and the presence of the ocean on the climate of Western Europe. This is showing, in fact, the annual mean, and the asymmetry in the mean temperature is even more extreme, in fact, for the winter temperature. So today we are also worried because the temperature are evolving. They are evolving because of global warming. And as you know, the whole world has warmed. This is the map. This is the I took the one from the IPCC report of 2013. There is an equivalent map for the last report. It's less, it's exactly the same. This is showing, in fact, the trend. Actually, the trend over the century of surface temperature, and what we can see is that the whole world has warmed, especially on continent, but there is an anomaly. In fact, there is a cooling, there is a warming hole in the North Atlantic, and some we will go back to that during the day. Some authors think very and are very enthusiastic about this idea that this is the first sign of the slowdown of the AMOC circulation, of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is transporting heat. So a slowdown of this circulation is would decrease the temperature. So this is the idea behind that. And while other authors are against that, so there is a debate about the origin, and we will go back to that with a few lectures during the day, I believe, about this the idea of that we have today about the presence and the mechanisms that are underlying, in fact, the formation of this Atlantic warm hole that is not only apparently linked to the circulation. This is a map. This is an equivalent map for the SST, for the sea surface temperature, with the warming hole in the North Atlantic, with the Hadley SST database. And the temperature has evolved over the last century, but not only. In fact, we have also salinities that have changed. So this is these are a few graphs summarizing, in fact, the changes of salinity. These are maps of surface salinity, climatology of surface salinity, the mean salinity integrated over 2 kilometers. That shows, in fact, the contrast in salinity between the North Atlantic and the North Pacific very clearly. And these are the lower panels show, in fact, the trends, the changes over the century. And you can see that the sea surface salinities have changed, and also the 2 kilometer mean salinity has changed dramatically, especially with an increase of salinity and a freshening in the North Atlantic. So these effects should have and probably already have some influences on the global overturning circulation, and especially its branch in the Atlantic. And we will hear more about this, but oceanographers have instrumented sections to study, in fact, directly the flow of the AMOC, especially at different positions, especially since almost 20 years at 26 north between the Strait of Florida to the Canaries, with a section with, there will be several talks that will go back, in fact, to this rapid section. And actually, for historical aspect, you can also look at the video. I mean, we had a previous meeting in 2012, 10 years ago, and I invited, in fact, Harry Bryden, who was a key player and one of the founder of the experiment from Southampton. So he gave us at the time, in fact, the idea of the change of circulation. So this is one of the most recent paper, probably not the last one, but which is showing that the AMOC transport apparently has changed in a step. We will go back to that with other colleagues. But there are some data that show that things are already happening, at least for the temperature, this is clear, and the salinity, and maybe for the circulation. Obviously, it's possible also, and we will hear more on that also today, it's possible to use numerical models to simulate and understand, so coupled models with the ocean, with other components of the climate system, with obviously the atmosphere. And when we look at the compilation of the mean of the CEMIP-6 model simulation for the end of the century, either with an optimistic greenhouse gas scenario or with a pessimistic scenario, they show different, I mean, basically the same thing. So warming everywhere, almost everywhere, warming concentrated in the northern latitude on the continent. But each of these compilation, and so it means that most of the models are also still showing a warming hole in the North Atlantic, and the warming hole is not a cooling in that case for the pessimistic greenhouse gas scenario, but it's still a feature that can be seen in the maps. And the CEMIP-6 models have also been studied, in fact, to look directly at the flux of the AMOC expressed in sphere drop. I mean, here these are the deviation of the anomaly of the sphere drop in sphere drop of the circulation, and this is what is provided, in fact, in the last IPCC report, showing that if anything, the AMOC will continue, in fact, to decrease according to models. This is at the end of the 20th century, 21st century. So this is what is projected. There will be several presentations about the topic today, probably to correct this already 1 year old compilation. The other aspect that can be studied are ancient climate. And so this is Obviously, we don't have the same level of accuracy of and precision of data, but it's possible to be imaginative, and this is what started with geologists, and it's one of the key geologists who was very much into trying to propose a theory of changes of the circulation to explain changes of climate was a geologist from the US, from the University of Chicago, Thomas Schroeder Chamberlain. He was the first, actually. He was interested by mapping the US moraines. He's well known for this, for doing the classification of American glaciations. He also battled at the time against James Crowell, who was the key person for the astronomical theory. It was, I mean, much before Milankovitch. And he was proposing that CO2, the greenhouse effect, and changes of deep sea current could do the job for changing. Most of his ideas about the role of the ocean are published in a paper published in 1906 on a possible reversal of deep sea circulation and its influence on geologic climates. Obviously, at that time, there was absolutely no data, so it could be very speculative, and there was... that's the reason why it has not been very much noticed, but still, it is one of the first key papers about the subject. What the geological community had to do, and the marine geologists had to do, was to develop proxies to be measured on geological archives that are related, in fact, to the deep flow in. This is what started in the 50s with the use of especially isotopic traces that can be studied in sediments and that are related, in fact, to gradients in the oceans. And one of the key one that was used quite early is the fractionation of carbon of the stable isotopes, so C13, there is about 1% of C13 among 99% of C12, but photosynthesis is fractionating quite a lot by 20 per mil, by 2% the C13 to C12 ratio, and because of that, because of the plankton is also fractionating by minus 20 per mil organic matter that is formed. In fact, the DIC, the dissolved inorganic carbon, is quite heavy, is elevated because of mass balance. It is at the surface of the ocean, the value is about 1 to 2 per mil above the global mean ocean, which is at zero by definition, because the standard that is used is an ocean sample. I mean, and obviously, because of this contrast of the surface DIC and the deep DIC, it's possible to use that as a tool, in fact, to reconstruct if we can find archives that preserve, in fact, the signal. So this was, I think that I have to speed up a little bit what I'm showing, because I had prepared, in fact, several slides, in fact, to explain to you a bit more about the proxies that we are using in paleoceanography, but this is a slide, in fact, summarizing the use of C13 as a DIC tracer. This is a map showing, in fact, the modern simplified delta C13, so the C13 to C12 ratio normalized to a standard, and we can see that the NADW is very high, and along the transport, because organic matter gets remineralized. Obviously, there is a decrease of the C13 during the transport. Globally, the organic matter is going back to DIC. And there is a nice relationship for the global ocean between C13 and oxygen. This is a relationship for all water masses in the Atlantic, the Southern Ocean, the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, showing, in fact, this trend that can be used, in fact, to reconstruct, in fact, the flow. Another popular proxy that has been used in paleoceanography is protactinium thorium, very, I mean, protactinium is a quite exotic tracer, but the key aspect is that uranium is dissolved in the ocean. It has a more or less constant concentration. It's a conservative element, and it is decaying. Uranium-238 is decaying, uranium-235 is decaying, and you have a decay chain that is at secular equilibrium. There are two key very unsolvable elements, thorium-230 that is extremely unsolvable, and protactinium-231 that is less that is also very unsolvable, but less unsolvable than thorium. And because of this difference in solubility and residence time in the water column, when you have transport, the two isotopes will get fractionated chemically. In other words, if the ocean was just still with no movement, we should expect a production ratio in activity of 0.09. And because of differential transport, when you have transport, especially in the North Atlantic, AMOC, when the AMOC is strong, we have a decrease of the ratio. We can use also another exotic element, neodymium isotopes can also be used to study the global overturning circulation, because there are gradients between the input neodymium ratio from different rivers that are draining, in fact, different continents. And because of that, there is a mixing in the ocean for the dissolved neodymium, but it's possible to affect, in fact, the gradients by changing, in fact, the flux of the deep water. And there is also some direct also aspect. In fact, in some very special areas where, especially in overflows, where you have contact with between a high-speed bottom current and directly the sediment, the sediment can be sorted. The granulometry of the sediment can be changed by the deep sea current. And in that case, in very special location, it's possible to have an increase of the granulometry in. Versus, in fact, with respect to the flow speed at depth. And this relationship is, I mean, there are a few calibration of that, but it is local. I mean, here you have different local calibration for that, but this has been a tool that has been used, in fact, to reconstruct also the speed in very special areas of overflow. And this is, here you have two examples of recent time series of overflow changes here from the Iceland basin, the Iceland-Scotland overflow, with variations of this granulometry. And here they attempted a correlation with the NAO. I won't give any detail about this. And this is a more recent paper about the Labrador Sea, claiming that there is a distinct change over the last century of the flux of the Labrador Sea, as seen with both temperature, salinity proxies, and also this granulometry proxy. I mentioned carbon-14, both for the modern ocean, the natural carbon-14 at depths for the apparent ages, and also the BOM C14. It's also possible to use carbon-14 as a tracer and clock for carbon transport in the past, provided that we have another control on the chronology. I can't give any details, but basically the idea is to go in the past, measure carbon-14 in different type of carbonates that grew from seawater, either at the surface, like planktonic foramifera, or at depths, like benthic foramifera. But you have all sorts of organisms, such as coralline algae, corals, deep sea corals. One of the difficulties with carbon-14 is that the clock is measuring the travel time in the deep sea, but also it is affected by air-sea gas exchange. So if the air-sea gas exchange is not complete, obviously the beginning the activity at the surface is not the same as the atmosphere. So clearly we need, in fact, to correct for that. But when things are being done properly, it's possible, in fact, to use carbon-14 as a paleoceanographic tool. So this is, again, taken from the recent compilation with Luc. Probably we'll expand much more on this. This is just a compilation of benthic foramifera, C14 ages. This is a profile for the glacial ocean for all locations. The profile between 1 kilometer and 5 kilometer depths in blue, and you have the modern profile, which is represented in red. So the basic idea is that here the deep ocean C14 age has increased by almost a millennium, and it's also possible to map this and to look at the distribution of carbon-14 for the Indo-Pacific and also the Atlantic versus the latitude and the depth. The other, another example of large changes of the AMOC is not only the last glacial maximum, but during the last glacial period since 100,000 years, there were large and abrupt drops of the AMOC proxies that we can study in sediment. So this is taken from a paper by Henri et al. In 2016, where they measured, in fact, again, this protactinium. So here the ratio is with an inverted scale. 0.09 is the value for no motion in the deep ocean. And when you have lower values, it means that protactinium gets transported somewhere else in the North Atlantic. So you can see that there is a viability. There is also some connection, some correlation with the C13 obtained in the same core. And basically what it shows is that during there was a systematic viability and drop of the AMOC circulation. I mean, it's difficult to quantify by how much, but and it corresponds, in fact, to climate changes studied in the same core. Here, it's possible to measure the sea surface temperature, for example, with molecular proxies like this one. Here, it's based on alkenons, and you have also a comparison with the similar temperature changes based on ice core work with what are called the Dansgaard, Oeschger, and Henrik stadials, which are the cooling. So during each cooling linked especially to Henrik stadials, what we call Henrik stadials, there is a drop, a drastic drop of all the proxies, neodymium, protactinium, thorium, C13, that are indicative of a drop of the AMOC circulation. This is a zoom for and a review, I mean a review of the literature for the AMOC drop during the last deglaciation, where you have the Henrik 1 at 17K and another drop that is less extreme at 12K, based on again on this protactinium thorium with the production ratio which is here. So basically during the extreme part of the H1 Henrik 1 event, the deep ocean was more or less still. There was more or less no movement. This is the reason why we find the production ratio of protactinium and thorium. So this is a time series of the in the same region of the AMOC based on C13, the same time scale, the last 20,000 years, yes, with drops of C13 corresponding to Henrik I, Younger Dryas. Here you have also the granulometry proxy. And now what is the link with climate? I already gave you a glimpse on this aspect, but for H1, actually, the first paper that reported, in fact, a significant and abrupt cooling around 17K, I mean, in carbon-14, this is equivalent to 14K, is something that we did, in fact, 35 years ago. And at that time, we were very surprised by a drastic cooling that is here. These are temperatures over the last 20,000 years. The ages are indicated here, because this was the first use of carbon-14 by IMS on foraminifera. We were indicating the ages directly on the curve, but so here you have the depth that is evolving that way, so zero time is here. And we were very surprised by this massive cooling. So it was in 87. We did not know what to do about it. I mean, this is what we wrote at that time, that there was a drastic temperature drop of 7 degrees, and we said that it can be surely attributed to a pulse-like injection of large volume of ice or meltwater into the Atlantic. So it was we did not do much more about this. And we know now that this Heinrich I, like the other Heinrich events, are due, in fact, to breakup of the Laurentide ice sheet that was present, that was, 4 kilometers of ice directly on Canada. And from time to time, this Laurentide ice sheet was collapsing partly and draining icebergs into the Atlantic, putting ice-crafted debris that we can study in the sediment, but also putting fresh water. And this is just pictures of modern transport of rock debris. We know that it's coming from the Laurentide, because just by mapping, in fact, IRD, the ice-crafted debris layers in sediment, it's possible to see that that there is a decrease of thickness of the IRD layer, starting from the Labrador Sea into the Atlantic. I mean, the core that I studied during my PhD that I showed just before was here. So we were completely out of this influence. But we went back, in fact, to the same core by adding a new paleothermometric estimate with molecular proxy, and we counted the IRDs on 10 grams of sediment, and we found them, in fact. So the icebergs coming from the Laurentide came up to the southern part of the Iberian margin. We also studied an index for the low salinity that was produced by the melting of the iceberg. So it was there. It was waiting for us. Unfortunately, I did not see that in 87. I was not courageous enough to count, in fact, IRDs in the same core, because we were not imagining at that time that, even if we wrote that in the paper, we were not imagining that the icebergs were coming from the Laurentide all the way across the Atlantic. So for this time period, it's possible also to compile. We did a compilation of many temperature time series for the last glaciation with colleagues, and we did a compilation of 80 paleotemperature series, not only the ones from the Iberian margin. And it was enlightening, because when we do this, when we do an average temperature change over the last glaciation, which is, and we try to separate, in fact, the northern hemisphere from the southern hemisphere. This is the graph that is shown here. These are delta of temperature based on all those cores at different locations on the Earth. The temperature in the southern hemisphere is starting to rise much earlier. Whereas the temperature in the northern hemisphere is showing, in fact, exhibiting transients, like here and here. And when we do, in fact, when we did, in fact, the inter-hemispheric gradient of temperature, we can see this W-shape curve that is more or less reminiscent of the AMOC proxy of the Protactinium, which is shown here on the same time scale. So clearly, this transient and this asymmetry between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere is linked to the ocean. At that time, we were collaborating with the NCAR group and for modeling, and this is these are simulations that we have done over on the last glaciation with a full-fledged GCM, coupling, in fact, ocean and atmosphere, where the calculation went through the last glaciation. So this is a map, in fact, showing the temperature at the surface during H1 minus the glacial. So this is the cooling effect that we have seen in the North Atlantic. But in parallel to this cooling effect, there is a north-south thermal seesaw that is very apparent. So the southern hemisphere is warming while the northern hemisphere is cooling, especially in the North Atlantic. So that's the effect of the drop of this circulation of the AMOC and GOC. These are the AMOC stream functions in the calculation. Here, this is for H1, where we can see that there is a distinct drop of the circulation. It's possible also with the with this model also to look in more details the transient simulation for different locations, and this is taken from the same paper. Subsequent paper, but exactly with the same modeling experiment, with a focus on three key areas: Greenland, in comparison with the data. The data are shown in black. I mean, I should show, in fact, that here. The complete model with all the forcings over the last glaciation that are changes of the orbital changes, changes of the albedo linked to the presence of the ice sheets, changes of the greenhouse gases, such as CO2 especially, and changes of the AMOC, of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, are included in the simulation that are represented on the lower panel, where we can see that there is a good match between the data and the simulation that are represented in red. And this is true for both Greenland, the South Atlantic, and also Antarctica. And basically, what we see is the deglaciation, so an increase of temperature over this time period between 21 and 14 K during the last deglaciation. But the aspect that is quite important is that with the model, you can separate, in fact, the different forcings. And this is what has been done in that calculation. In fact, the upper diagrams show the calculation only with the AMOC changes in red here, and you can see that it produces a cooling even more extreme than seen in Greenland. For the South Atlantic, the drop of the AMOC is producing, in fact, an increase of temperature. This is the seesaw that we talked about before. And for Antarctica, the temperature is also rising during that time period. And so you have a seesaw effect when you compare Greenland and Antarctica. The seesaw was also studied in the case, with the model, in the case of the Iberian margin. So in that case, this is the comparison between our data and the Iberian margin simulation for the over the last deglaciation based on this model that is producing, in fact, a significant drop of the AMOC during the ENRIC 1 event that is here and that, in fact, follows us since 87. I mean, I see that I already talked too much. I had three more slides, but I will skip them. I wanted to speak about the warm route and the Agulhas and Benguela and retroflexion and what we can do about this with in paleoceanography. So because we worked on that topic precisely with deep sea sediment cores to study, in fact, the complexity in the deep past. So, I think that I will skip that and the work of others on the subject, and also the modeling of these aspects that are related to probably a shift in the southwesterly winds that is affecting, in fact, the valve, the passage between the South Indian Ocean to the Atlantic, with the quite complex flow with rings and return currents and so on, but it can be studied in parallel to what we are doing in paleoceanography. So I will stop here and probably not welcome much questions because I already spoke too much, but I give you back here the program of the day about the variation of the global overturning circulation. Thank you for your attention.